In the annals of revolutionary history, few figures have inspired as much awe and controversy as Toussaint Louverture. Born into slavery on a Saint-Domingue plantation, this self-educated military genius would rise to become the architect of the world's first successful slave revolution. Barack Obama listed C.L.R. James' The Black Jacobins, a seminal work on Toussaint, among his favorite books, while Martin Luther King Jr. frequently invoked Toussaint's legacy in the speeches. Even Napoleon Bonaparte, who would ultimately betray him, grudgingly acknowledged him as the most capable and intelligent Negro. Toussaint's revolution shattered the myth of white supremacy, demonstrating that enslaved people could not only fight for their freedom, but govern themselves with sophistication and vision. His life embodied the revolutionary era's most radical promise, that liberty, equality, and fraternity could transcend race and transform a society built on brutal exploitation into one founded on universal human dignity. Toussaint's claim to having acquired the soul of freedom before the revolution was well earned through his grueling journey from slavery. This independence of spirit became a defining characteristic of his politics, expressed in his constant efforts to transcend imposed limitations. The quest to liberate himself from external domination was the main continuity between his pre- and post-revolutionary life. Though he was among the few black men in Saint-Domingue who escaped bondage, he didn't boast about this achievement, instead emphasizing to fellow blacks that he had been a slave like all of you. Many of his later character traits were already formed before the revolution. His physical habits, pushing himself to limits, constant movement, minimal sleep and food, pride, prudence, religiosity, talent for compromise, secretiveness, and, notably, his abhorrence of violence, likely stemming from his work as a healer and his religious values. While Toussaint shared some ideals with other black freedmen, opposing slavery while valuing hard work and merit, this view underestimates the importance of fraternity in his values. For him, fraternity wasn't merely philosophical, but lived experience through active engagement in various networks. From his base at Breda, he moved seamlessly across overlapping circles, drawing strength from his extended family, Alada culture, Creole and Bosal brethren, and fellow Catholics. As patriarch, he combined idealism and generosity with pragmatism, watching over personal interests while involving himself in his boss's affairs and occasionally entering the worlds of healers, voodoo followers, and Macandalas traders. In the late 1780s, he forged strong bonds with fellow slave elites in Saint-Domingue's northern plain, participating in Sunday meetings that laid groundwork for the 1791 insurrection. Recent research has uncovered his connections with future revolutionary leaders, including Jean-François Papillon, Jeannot Boulet, and the Bossal rebel Sans Souci. Most startling was his connection to Jean-Jacques Dessalines, later Haiti's first leader, who was among 13 slaves Toussaint supervised for his son-in-law and was eventually inherited by Toussaint's daughter. Despite his experiences with the brutality and racism of Saint-Domingue's slave system, Toussaint's view of human nature wasn't racialized. His encounters with Jesuit missionaries and Bayon de Libertat nurtured his belief in the capacity for goodness in all humans. This perspective formed spiritual links through voodoo and Catholic traditions with the indigenous Taino culture known for gentleness and love of nature. Toussaint's troops absorbed military virtues enthusiastically, with honor being first among them. Their solidarity was exemplary. They supported each other, fought for each other, and losses only strengthened their resolve. When his forces stormed Camp Martineau, they were motivated by rage over the death of their fallen hero, Brigadier Biret, swearing to avenge his murder. Most significantly, all segments of his diverse army, European soldiers, regular troops, and local Bosale militias, worked in complete harmony as true Republicans. La Plume noted that his men were fighting as good Frenchmen, illustrating how Saint-Domingue's revolutionaries had embraced Republican principles of fraternity and citizenship. Yet this Frenchness came with a crucial local dimension. Toussaint's troops understood they weren't merely fighting foreign occupiers, but struggling to permanently eradicate slavery from the colony. This Republican spirit galvanized them, symbolized during the Camp Martineau battle when Sergeant Gabriel, despite intense enemy fire, scaled a pole and tore down this infamous banner of tyranny. For these fighters, Frenchness represented their determination to preserve their freedom and resist re-enslavement. When addressing his soldiers, Toussaint often compared himself to a bird of prey who could find no landing place while the freedom of his brothers remained threatened. The cohesion of Toussaint's Republican Army was further demonstrated by their ethical standards, strict adherence to prohibitions against pillaging, and humane treatment of prisoners. Toussaint proudly noted that soldiers wanted to exceed the generosity shown by their officers and officers that of their commanders. This compassion extended beyond his troops to black populations in Republican territories. He related how a British soldier owed his life to a cultivator who had found him wounded after battle, tended his wounds, fed him, and escorted him to the nearest Republican position. Toussaint beamed with pride. It is by this sort of behavior that, despite the cruelty of her enemies, the people of Saint-Domingue will convince the entire universe that even though they have only just begun their journey towards regeneration, they know how to appreciate liberty at its true value and how to practice the Republican virtues. Toussaint challenged racist claims that black people lacked moral capacity by drawing on Rousseau, arguing that while Saint-Domingue's black population lacked formal education, their proximity to nature gave them powerful intuitions about justice and goodness. Despite slavery's terrible legacy, they still showed warmth and affection for their former masters and were willing to regard them as brothers. Toussaint also refuted claims that black people lacked understanding of metaphysics and law, supposedly only comprehending authority through their masters. He rejected the perverse proposition that victims were to blame for their bondage, including accusations that black people sold their own children into slavery in Grande Rivière. Toussaint responded that such practices only occurred in British-controlled territories, not Republican parts of the colony, and placed responsibility on Europeans who established and profited from slavery. The real monsters, he argued, were not the dehumanized black communities, but civilized men who enslaved Africans and now sought to restore slavery in Saint-Domingue. Toussaint further countered denials of black people's Frenchness, offering a lesson in civic republicanism. Patriotism was neither about race nor color, but expressed through political will and commitment to the French Constitution. Black citizens cherished their Frenchness because it symbolized their freedom. By characterizing Sontenac's approach as false republicanism and denatured patriotism, Toussaint challenged French revolutionary thinking, combining universal values with Saint-Domingue's specific situation. His innovative concept of civic order-based citizenship, not only on abstract principles, but on active participation in community defense, legitimizing the 1791 slave revolt as a pillar of Republican Saint-Domingue. He placed the black struggle for freedom on equal footing with the French revolutionaries who overthrew the Ancien Régime in 1789. However, transforming this fraternal vision into reality posed challenges, as Toussaint's scheme granted black people few entitlements and many obligations. His people needed to rise above internal divisions, prove worthy of their hard-won freedoms through collective example, forgive former oppressors, and fight to the death to protect their liberty. Toussaint concluded his response to Vianney with defiance. His people would prefer to bury themselves in the ruins of their country rather than face the prospect of the restoration of slavery. The successful mobilization of Toussaint's plantation supporters against Hédouville was no accident. His local political style drew on varied methods to rally communities across Saint-Domingue. His followers compared him to Macandal, the legendary Maroon leader, symbolically transferring this powerful cultural association to their new hero. This reincarnation appealed to both Catholic and Caribbean sensibilities while aligning with Republican rationalism. Toussaint built his power through patronage, securing positions for supporters as surveyors, priests, medical officers, and justices. He personally intervened in cases of injustice, particularly helping women in distress, cementing his reputation for compassion. His local philosophy combined Republican ideals with Creole natural morality. Religion formed another pillar of Toussaint's influence. A devout Catholic who maintained correspondence with Abbe Gregoire, he attended Mass weekly and employed chaplains who served as both confessors and counselors. Yet Toussaint remained immersed in Vodou culture as well, reportedly consulting its priests as soothsayers. Toussaint's religiosity blended spiritual idealism with pragmatism. He composed his own prayers, credited his victories to divine intervention, and understood religion's healing potential in a war-torn colony. He mandated religious observance in his army, requiring battalion commanders to lead troops in prayer twice daily and attend Sunday Mass in full kit, believing that religious practice would improve both morality and military discipline. Addressing his soldiers in May 1797, Toussaint emphasized, "Adore God and be irreproachable in your practice of religion. This will then inspire all the men and women of the colony, from the landowners to the agricultural workers, to be good citizens." He hoped his virtuous military would encourage all Saint-Domingue's people to follow gospel teachings and serve the public interest. Alongside his Masonic, charitable, and religious networks, Toussaint relied heavily on municipal institutions, which he called representatives of the common good, guardians of the Constitution, and guarantors of wisdom, prudence, and tranquility. He skillfully used municipal ceremonies to address local populations about Saint-Domingue's social and economic regeneration. At Mont Saint-Nicolas in October 1798, after the British withdrawal, Toussaint planted a Tree of Liberty and delivered a speech blending Republican and Creole elements. He equated Frenchness with liberty and reminded his audience that liberation from British rule meant emancipation from the bonds of slavery. The sacred sapling represented all citizens regardless of age, occupation, or color. While praising his soldiers' valor, he emphasized that their reward should be the generous satisfaction of seeing former slaves gathered freely around the Liberty Tree. Toussaint's imagination flourished most when in motion. In early February 1801, while his edicts were transforming Santo Domingo, he issued a proclamation to all island citizens. After praising his army's courage and expressing wishes for the happiness of Saint-Domingue, which he now routinely called Mon Pays, he invited municipal authorities to select representatives for a central assembly in Port-Republican that March. Their task, drafting laws suited to our habits, customs, climate, and industry, while strengthening our ties to the French Republic. This document would be sent to Paris for approval before becoming law. Having expelled foreign troops, established military authority, defeated the Southern Rebellion, neutralized French envoys, outmaneuvered Spanish authorities, and unified Hispaniola under French Republican rule, Toussaint was embarking on his boldest venture yet, a new constitution. The Assembly's draft included sections on agriculture and commerce, executive powers of the governor, justice system reform, municipal reform, and financial rationalization. It reflected Toussaint's concern with public morality, Catholicism as the official religion, divorce banned in the interests of encouraging and fortifying family unity, the governor's duty to prohibit subversive texts that might corrupt collective morals, and oversight of activities threatening public spirit, security, health, or fortune of the citizens. Toussaint received the draft constitution in early May 1801 and spent 2 months perfecting it and its related organic laws. Though aware of legislators' reservations about succession and executive powers, he knew he needed full authority, especially as Paris was considering appointing a governor with combined civilian and military functions. For Toussaint, the Constitution merely formalized Saint-Domingue's existing political reality. Widespread enthusiasm for Toussaint's leadership existed throughout the colony. Whites regarded him as their protector, praising his humanity and respect for religion, and understanding that European presence was essential for preservation of commerce and the arts. Black citizens also strongly supported him. Local communities frequently expressed their confidence in his leadership. The municipality of Gros Morne declared, "We do not need Rome or any other agent. We have confidence only in the commander-in-chief." While Lacroix de Bouquet asserted, "Only the commander-in-chief can restore Saint-Domingue to its former glory." In early July, Toussaint announced the constitutional ceremony for July 7th in Cap. Citizens were awakened at 3 in the morning by cavalry drummers and brass players, with troops and National Guardsmen assembled by 5. Toussaint arrived precisely at 5:30, preceded by civil and military authorities. Distinguished guests included assembly members, American Ambassador Tobias Lair, his predecessor Edward Stevens, and even the reluctant Moise, whom Toussaint wanted in plain sight. The ceremony was meticulously crafted to justify the power Saint-Domingue reclaimed from France and vested in Toussaint. 3 complimentary speeches were delivered by Borgella, Toussaint himself, and Foucault, with Toussaint clearly having vetted and influenced all 3. In a bold move, Borgella announced that due to the absence of laws creating imminent peril, Toussaint must put the Constitution into immediate execution rather than waiting for French approval. This self-endorsement was met with enthusiastic roars from the crowd. Toussaint's doctrine of public interest was most controversially applied in his agrarian policies. The 1801 Constitution aimed to revive the colony's agricultural exports, which had collapsed completely by the mid-1790s. In his instructions, Toussaint reminded officials that the island's prosperity depended entirely on agricultural output, calling it the condition of our freedom, the cause of our country's wealth, and of the happiness of all individuals, and the foundation of public order. Believing rapid export increases required restoring the plantation economy rather than dividing land into small holdings, which would need bureaucracy and transportation infrastructure Saint-Domingue lacked, Toussaint entrusted this revival not only to white planters, but also to deserving officials and military leaders. State-seized abandoned properties were leased to figures like Christophe, Moïse, and Dessalines, who amassed considerable fortunes. Dessalines alone controlled 30 sugar plantations, each yielding 100,000 francs annually. Toussaint himself owned multiple plantations and purchased a large estate in Cap Plain from a wealthy American-based landowner named Lefebvre, entrusting its operation to French Consul General Pichon. The challenge was enormous. Plantations remained in disarray with reluctant workers lacking stake in production. Toussaint's October 1800 decree imposed martial order on agriculture, demanding submission and obedience from laborers. The draconian measures prohibited workers from leaving plantations without permission, criminalized vagrancy, required military-style discipline, and treated fugitives like army deserters. Army commanders, particularly Dessalines, enforced this system with notorious thoroughness, conducting regular inspections and inflicting severe beatings on underperforming managers and foremen. Dessalines also swept major towns like Port-Républicain, sending anyone without proper documentation immediately to plantations. This harsh regime evoked slavery for the black masses, despite their legal payment of 1/4 of harvests. Though whips remained banned, clubs, cocomacocs, were reintroduced and widely used, causing enormous resentment. Some white planters mistakenly believed the decree gave them absolute domination over workers without legal protections, forcing Toussaint to issue another proclamation punishing such incendiary talk. Workers responded by deserting plantations in droves, with evidence suggesting more morons, runaways, in certain northern districts by 1800 than before 1791. Toussaint's all-out economic mobilization showed impressive results despite critics' claims of failure. By the end of 1801, sugar and coffee production had risen to a third of their 1789 levels, while cotton exports reached nearly 60% of pre-revolutionary levels by 1802. Official records showed import and export duties reaching 8.3 million francs in 1800, with cargo taxes alone exceeding 20 million francs in 1801. Contemporary observers noted tenfold increases on specific plantations. Though sectors like indigo showed little recovery and more capital investment was needed, the plantation system proved remarkably efficient economically, but at significant political cost. After suppressing Moise's rebellion, Toussaint's brief respite was shattered by news of Franco-British peace preliminaries in October 1801. He immediately grasped the dire implications. This diplomatic shift would undermine his regional alliances and potentially open the way for a French invasion. By early December, rumors of such an invasion pervaded Saint-Domingue. The threat was real. In late November, Jamaica's Governor Nugent abruptly terminated negotiations with Toussaint and ordered all British subjects to withdraw from Saint-Domingue. Meeting with British representative Whitfield, Toussaint complained of Franco-British collusion against him, vowing resistance and refusing to relinquish command. Whitfield observed Toussaint actively recruiting soldiers and purchasing horses, preparing to try his strength with Bonaparte's legions. Toussaint issued a proclamation to prepare his people, simultaneously denying and confirming the invasion rumors. He revealed that Bonaparte had conscripted blacks and people of color in France to fight against their compatriots, was holding his children as hostages, and intended to eliminate the colonial army and restore slavery. In a more conciliatory tone than recent proclamations, he praised Saint-Domingue's people and appealed to his army's loyalty. His language grew somber as he declared, "France does not have the right to enslave us. Our freedom does not belong to her." Comparing France's attack to parents attempting to kill their child, he asserted that in such monstrous circumstances, ethical rules of obedience must be suspended. He concluded with dignified resolve, "If I have to die under these circumstances, I will face death honorably, like a soldier who has led an exemplary life." On January 29, 1802, Toussaint witnessed the arrival of the French fleet at Cape Samana while inspecting coastal defenses. Seeing at least 25 naval vessels already anchored, including 10 massive ships carrying 1,000 men each, with dozens more on the horizon, he immediately grasped the scale of Bonaparte's operation. "We must perish," he told his officers. "All of France has come to Saint-Domingue. They have been deceived, and they have come to seek vengeance." Toussaint, though reduced to approximately 6,000 men by mid-February, was revitalized by defending Saint-Domingue. His republican war instincts returned as he donned the mantle of national liberator. He delivered a powerful speech to his soldiers, reminding them of their ancestors' suffering and their glorious conquest of liberty, declaring the French had come to restore slavery, driven by the hatred and ambition of the consul. He prophesied the invaders' fate. "Those who will be spared by our sword will receive death at the hands of our vengeful climate." The 72-day spring campaign of 1802 was Toussaint's last and greatest stand. Supported by commanders André Vernet and Charles Belair, he combined conventional warfare with guerrilla tactics. Constantly mobile and sleeping only a few hours nightly on a plank, he led the French on exhausting mountain chases while remaining elusive. After burning Genoese, he retreated to the Cahos Mountains to retrieve hidden weapons caches and launched merciless ambushes on French positions. By late March 1802, Toussaint began exploring the possibility of a truce, a tactical move consistent with his career-long approach of engaging enemies when strategically advantageous. After Creek du Pierrot, he approached General Boudet, one of Leclerc's senior officers. Though Toussaint attempted to bypass Leclerc by communicating directly with Bonaparte through Boudet, he was rebuffed. After the truce, Toussaint returned to his headquarters at Marmalade, where he bid an emotional farewell to his chief of staff and veteran cavalrymen. Per the agreement with Leclerc, his guard was redeployed and he kept only a symbolic retinue. He then retired to his Habitat Sensei estate in Ennery, where he briefly glimpsed the quiet life he had often yearned for, surrounded by family, receiving local dignitaries, and taking daily horse rides, though maintaining his characteristically intense pace. On June 7th, the French trapped Toussaint by inviting him to meet General Brunet at the Georges plantation. Despite warnings of a trap, Toussaint attended with only an aide-de-camp and a servant. He was promptly arrested, put on a ship to Cap, and separated from his family. French troops looted his Ennery property, stealing money, clothing, furniture, and art under the pretense of searching for papers. In the aftermath of the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture emerged as an iconic figure across the Atlantic world, a symbol of revolutionary power that inspired those fighting for slave emancipation and radical political change. Though Toussaint himself did little to export his revolution, his legend spread rapidly, embodying contrasting characteristics: good governance and racial equality, alongside the subversive power of black liberation. Even while imprisoned in the Jura Mountains, Toussaint's fame grew. As Fidel Castro later reflected from his own prison cell, at a time when Napoleon was imitating Caesar, the soul of Spartacus was reborn in Toussaint Louverture. This inspirational quality established Toussaint as both a liberating hero for the oppressed and a terrifying specter for slavery's defenders. Toussaint's influence sparked a new wave of slave rebellions across the Caribbean and Americas in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Revolts aimed not just at individual freedom, but at overthrowing slavery as a system. A spontaneous Louvertorian cult emerged through popular songs, celebrating racial equality and self-governance. In Jamaica, slaves sang "Black, White, and Brown" all the same, while in Venezuela, freemen and slaves rejoiced at Toussaint's victories, calling him the firebrand and warning authorities to watch out. By the time Toussaint left the political stage in the early 19th century, he had become the first black superhero of the modern age. His legend encompassed multiple dimensions: savior, military hero, lawgiver, symbol of emancipated blackness, and, as Wordsworth wrote, embodiment of man's unconquerable mind. Despite his own suppression of voodoo, Haitian tradition eventually placed him among the Loas, spirits, guided by Ogun Fer, the warrior god. Frederick Douglass, the renowned African-American abolitionist and civil rights leader, became one of the most eloquent champions of Toussaint's legacy in the late 19th century. Having served as American Consul General in Haiti, 1889 to 1891, and as Haiti's commissioner at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, Douglass possessed unique insights into Toussaint's historical significance. In powerful speeches, he emphasized how Saint-Domingue's revolutionaries had conquered freedom as a right against formidable opposition, when all the neighboring islands were slaveholding and the hand of the Christian world was against her. Toussaint's appeal to the anti-colonial imagination grew dramatically after World War II. Paul Robeson, campaigning for African-American civil rights and supporting national liberation movements, compared Ho Chi Minh to the Toussaint of Vietnam after the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Chilean poet Pablo Neruda celebrated Toussaint in his epic Canto General as a natural monarch whose revolutionary legacy made the cliffs burn, hidden branches speak, and hopes are transmitted. From the late 20th century, Toussaint's myth soared to new heights through novels, poetry, plays, paintings, and music, while being formally canonized as a global icon by public institutions. He remained a potent emblem of Haitian nationalism, celebrated by liberation theologian Jean-Bertrand Aristide after winning the 1990 presidential election, with murals appearing across Haiti. A youthful statue was erected near his birthplace at Haute-du-Cap, and the bicentenary of his 1801 constitution was widely commemorated with his face on a new 20-gourd banknote. Toussaint's international recognition expanded with busts in Miami and Montreal, cities with large Haitian communities, while a towering statue in Alada, Benin, reclaimed his Pan-African heritage. His progressive ideals were honored with a bust in Santiago de Cuba celebrating his role as emancipator, and his effigy appeared in Washington's National Museum of African American History and Culture near Jefferson, and a pile of bricks representing Jefferson's slaves. In South Africa, he was included in Freedom Park's Gallery of Leaders commemorating the anti-apartheid struggle. Toussaint's legacy extends beyond official commemorations to inspire contemporary struggles. The Lycée Toussaint Louverture in Pontarlier hails him as the precursor of global struggles for racial equality and founder of revolutionary internationalism embodied by figures like Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela. A 2016 West Belfast Republican mural depicted Toussaint alongside Mandela, King, and other legends of black emancipation, including Lincoln, Rosa Parks, Robeson, Ali, Marley, Biko, and Davis. Toussaint remains more than a historical relic. His struggle continues as a vital source of intellectual inspiration and progressive renewal in our age, reminding us that today's global injustices have deep historical roots. His life exemplifies classic Republican ideals: human dignity regardless of race, steadfastness against overwhelming odds, integrity, and refusal to compromise fundamental values, coexistence rather than separation, and the audacity to envision a radically different world. This ethic offers a foundation for a politics of hope rather than fear, promoting robust internationalism that challenges ethno-nationalism and avoiding the self-pitying negativity that often corrodes post-colonial narratives.